to finish. She can hear the sisters approaching behind her, but they hang back in the shadows.
Listen, I don't want to press you, the doctor says, but it's not safe for you to be out on this road at night. There's a lot of activity in this area. There have been some terrible stories. Maybe you already know.
Soledad snorts again, but this time it's a solitary sound. She can no longer locate what was funny about it before.
Concern creases the doctor's face. A mini flashlight dangles from his keychain, and this he clicks on. He turns the small beam toward the girl's legs to confirm what he thought he could see or smell there in the darkness, a significant amount of blood. And not only on Rebecca's jeans. Lydia can see now. Soledad's are covered as well, and the blood there isn't dry.
Luca is still drinking.
The doctor clicks off the flashlight. Please, he says, won't you let me help you?
Soledad crosses her arms. Rebecca makes her jaw into the shape of a square.
It's Luca who speaks up.
How do we know you're really a doctor?
Ah, the man puts a finger in the air, then retrieves a wallet from his back pocket. There's an identification card there. The man's picture. It says, Dr. Ricardo Montañero Alcan.
Luca breathes on it before handing it back.
That doesn't prove anything, Soledad observes. You can be a doctor and still be a narco, too. You can be a doctor, a teacher, a priest. You can be a federal police officer and still murder people.
The doctor nods, slipping the wallet back into the pocket of his jeans.
It's true, he concedes.
And why do you want to help us anyway? Soledad asks.
The man touches the gold crucifix around his neck.
For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink.
Lydia automatically blesses herself. A stranger, and you welcome me. She completes the line of scripture, passing the water jug to Rebecca, who drinks only a little before passing it to Soledad.
We should go with him, Luca declares.
The man lets Soledad scroll through his phone first. He shows her his Facebook page, photographs of his wife and children. She's so hungry, so depleted. She relents. The doctor wants to take them to his clinic, but they refuse. So he drives them into the city to a poorly whitewashed two-story building instead, with a shop on the bottom floor and bars on the windows above. Large red letters proclaim the building to be the Techo Rojo Motel. The shop beneath has a red awning and an open-air counter where two young women wear smock aprons and eye the approaching patrons with considerable suspicion. Behind them are shiny tinfoil snacks and bottled soft drinks in neon colors. There's also a grill, the aroma of cooking meat, and the shallow sound of a cheap radio playing música norteña, heavy on the accordion. The doctor buys them food and pays for their room.
If you want a ride to Culiacán tomorrow, I can come back in the morning, he says. And then he's gone before they even have time to thank him.
After they've eaten and locked themselves inside their tiny room, after they've managed to lug the wide, heavy nightstand across the carpet and wedge it beneath a doorknob for extra security, Lydia collects everyone's pants. The room does not have a bathroom, but there is, oddly, a toilet in one corner and a yellow sink beside it. The water that emerges from the faucet of that sink is the color of sand. But Lydia doesn't mind, because the discoloration serves to camouflage the colors she has to wash out of those jeans.
Luca's, Rebecca's, and Soledad's.
She uses the cracked bar of soap in the dish. And she scrubs and scrubs until finally the water she wrings from the denim returns to its original murky dun color. By the time she's finished, Luca is snoring softly on one of the room's two single beds, and the sisters, too, are already asleep, curled up together. Soledad cradles her sister's head in her arms,
and their hair is fanned out in one twisted black wave across their shared pillow. Lydia rummages through her pack for her toothbrush and rations a smear of paste onto the bristles. She considers the brown water from the tap before sticking the toothbrush under there and wetting it. At home, there was a whole routine before she got into bed. It could take 20 minutes some nights. Cold cream, toner, moisturizer, floss, toothpaste, mouthwash, lip balm. Some nights, tweezers, too, or clippers, or nail files. Of course, the occasional exfoliant or mask. Hand cream. Fluffy socks if her feet were chilly. Sebastian would whisper call from the bedroom, trying not to wake Luca in his impatience. Madre de Dios, wife! The Eiffel Tower was built faster! But when she was finished, he'd always fold back the covers to invite her in. He'd drape them over her when she was settled, along with the top half of himself. His breath was clean when he kissed her. Lydia avoids her reflection in the harsh yellow light of the rusty mirror. She spits into the sink and rinses her mouth. She splashes murky water over her face and neck and dries herself off with the shirt she wore for the last 2 days. When she finally slips into bed beside Luca, before she can even invoke her "don't think" mantra, exhaustion descends like anesthesia and blots out everything else. They sleep. Some hours later, and well before dawn, Rebecca wakens Lydia from a black sleep. "It's Soledad," Rebecca whispers to Lydia. "Something's wrong with her." Lydia disentangles herself from Luca, who smacks his lips in his sleep and then rolls tighter into a ball facing the wall. A good deal of light comes in through the room's only window, which has an insufficient curtain and is positioned beneath an overzealous street lamp. Lydia moves to the other twin bed, where Soledad sits rocking over her legs and clutching her stomach. "Soledad, are you okay?" She clenches her jaw and rocks her body forward. "Just bad cramps." Lydia looks up at Rebecca, whose face is a cloud of worry. "Just sit with Luca," Lydia says. "Make sure he stays asleep." Rebecca sits at the foot of Luca's bed. "Can you stand?" Lydia asks. Soledad gathers her strength and then rocks herself onto her feet. There's a dark stain on the mattress beneath her and the mineral scent of blood. Lydia grips her under the elbow and steers her around the bed toward the corner of the room where the plumbing is. She positions the flimsy curtain to give Soledad as much privacy as possible while she miscarries her baby. Good to his word, the doctor returns in the morning and drives them to Culiacán. The girls' jeans are still damp and stiff from Lydia's scrubbing, but they wear them anyway, and the sun isn't long drying them. It eats the moisture from their clothes and their hair and skin. Rebecca moves a little easier, and Soledad with a little more difficulty than yesterday. Lydia wants to buy a packet of sanitary napkins for Soledad, but they're expensive, so she puts her embarrassment away and asks the doctor, who, being a doctor, thinks nothing of the request and complies without hesitation. He also buys them breakfast and a tube of sunscreen, which he urges them to use, and for Luca, a comic book. When he takes his leave, he does so abruptly, to release them from the effort of gratitude. Lydia cannot wait to get back on the train, to get away from the nightmarish memories of this place, to be traveling north at high speed. She's terrified as they walk the tracks through the city that they will be spotted, that the guard from yesterday will be out driving to work. Do these men commute to work? Is that what they call it? Do they kiss their wives and children goodbye each morning and then climb into the family sedan and set out for a day of raping and extortion? And then return home exhausted in the evening and hungry for their pot roast? And he'll see her. He'll see the four of them walking north along the tracks, and the information will snap into place, and he'll remember. her face smiling beside Javier's in that picture. She pushes Luca gently in the back, ushers him into a faster pace. They cross over a muddy river on a skeletal railway bridge and discover a train yard where the tracks are lined on one side with giant boulders. A few clusters of migrants wait there, surrounded by the dirty colors of litter and debris, mud and weeds. There's a boy among them, slightly older than Luca, but certainly younger than Rebecca. He stands while the other migrants sit, hunching their shoulders against him. His eyes are unfocused, and his posture is the shape of a question mark. His hands float unsteadily in front of him, and he sways strangely on his curved legs.
"Mommy, what's wrong with him?" Luca asks.
He's the most disturbing child Luca has ever seen. He seems unaware of them, unaware of anything. Mommy shakes her head, but Soledad provides a one-word answer. "Drogas." They move quickly past the boy, away from the cluster of migrants he seems to be orbiting. In fact, they are nearly ready to quit the railway yard altogether when three well-dressed young women appear at a crossing ahead on the tracks. They wave their arms overhead and call out,
"Hermanos, tenemos comida!"
The men stand up from their clusters, pat the dust from their jeans, and gather for the offer of food. One of the three women reads loudly from the Bible, while the other two hand out tamales and atole. Luca's not hungry because, thanks to the doctor, they already had breakfast, but he's learned never to turn down a gift of calories. They eat gratefully, and when the women begin packing up their pots and gathering their spent rubbish, Lydia wonders if they should leave this place too. It feels squalid and dangerous, but there's a rumor that one of the trains parked here is being loaded, that soon it will journey north. Men are already climbing the ladders and spreading their packs out on top of the train. The railway workers watch and make no move to stop them. It seems so senseless and arbitrary, the way the government clears migrants from the trains in some places, spending millions of pesos and dollars to build those track fences in Oaxaca and Chiapas and Mexico State, all while turning a blind eye in other locations. There's even a policía municipal parked just there on the corner, watching the migrants board. He sips coffee from a paper cup. It feels almost like a trap, but Lydia's too grateful to flex her suspicion. The sisters' bodies are battered and weakened, especially Soledad's from the miscarriage. Being able to board while the train is stopped feels like luck, so they climb up gingerly, and Lydia can still get a whiff of blood from Soledad on the ladder above her. They move back along the top of the train until they come to a car where there's room for all four of them to be comfortable. Just as they're setting down, just as Lydia is pulling the canvas belts from her pack, a little girl peeks her head up over the edge of the train car. She clambers up quickly and approaches Soledad without hesitation. The girl is younger than Luca, perhaps 6 years old, and she's alone. Her black hair is cut short and shiny, and she wears jeans and brown leather boots. She hunkers down very close to Soledad, who's startled by the girl's boldness, the intimacy of her posture. She speaks rapidly, her upturned face very close to Soledad's. Soledad leans away from her.
"Do you need work?" the girl asks quickly. "My tia has a restaurant here, and she needs a waitress. Do you want a job?"
The girl puts her hand in Soledad's arm and tugs at her.
"Come on, quick. Come with me. I'll show you the place."
She pulls at Soledad's elbow, and Soledad is so taken aback that she nearly rises to follow the child. She knows she shouldn't, that the girl is presumptuous, almost bullying. But there's a conflict between Soledad's mind and her body, because her mind knows to mistrust this pushy little girl. But her body is biologically susceptible to the child's cuteness, to the beautiful innocence of her young face. Soledad feels momentarily distended between those two truths. But the spell is quickly broken because El Policía Municipal has gotten out of his car now and is standing in a patch of mud beneath the train, still carrying his paper cup of coffee. He yells up to the little girl, "Jimenita, leave those people alone! Get down from there!" The little girl snaps her head in his direction and bolts. She drops Soledad's arm and flings herself over the edge of the freight car and back down the ladder. She reappears a moment later in the distance, dashing away among the boulders and debris. El policía calls after her. "Tell your papi I said no víctimas for you today." Soledad is eager for the hiss of the disengaged brakes and the rumble of the locomotive. When at last they begin to move, instead of happiness or relief, they all feel a tentative, miniature suspension of dread. As they travel, Luca pays attention to the signs so he can check off familiar place names on his mind map or add new dots for unfamiliar ones. Guamuchil, Bamoa, Los Mochis. Check, check, check. Roughly 3 hours after pulling out of Culiacán, in the middle of nowhere, they come to a place where other tracks meet the ones they're traveling on, and then there are more and more tracks, until the rails are at least a dozen wide, and when the train slows down, Luca can see there are many migrants gathered here waiting, and again, no fence, no policías. Nothing at all to prevent the whole crowd of them from boarding La Bestia. The train stops, and easily 100 men get on while the train sits idling. But then the locomotive cuts its engine, and the workers disembark and scatter to cars parked in a nearby lot, and everyone atop the train groans and curses. La Bestia doesn't move again for 3 nights. Chapter 24. There are cultivated fields on both sides of the tracks, and Luca watches the farmer, sometimes on a tractor, sometimes on foot, as he tends to the rows of whatever crop he's hoping to grow there in the rich seams of dirt. The farmer lets the stranded migrants fill their bottles from a long hose, and the water it dispenses is warm but clean. Sometimes a family comes and sells food and refrescos out of the back of their truck, but sometimes they don't come, and Luca is very hungry. They rely on the kindness of their fellow migrants, who share their limited provisions. At night it gets cold, and some of the men build cheerful little campfires. Some folks sleep huddled up inside one of the empty freight cars, but it's crowded and smelly. And even though the boxcar cuts the wind, the metal seems to conduct the cold into the migrants' bones while they sleep. So Luca and Mami stay tucked in near one of the fires, wearing all of their clothes and wrapped up together in their blanket like a colorful burrito. Everyone is exhausted and edgy, and by the middle of the second day in that arid, desolate place, some migrants give up waiting and start to walk. Luca can't imagine where they'll walk to, because there was no town for miles before they stopped here. And what if there's no town for miles ahead, either? He worries about that, and he prays when he watches the migrants strike out along the tracks. When a crew of ferrocarril workers arrives on the morning of the fourth day and prepares a train to depart, a cheer gathers in the camp, and all the migrants begin to board. But Luca presses on his mommy's hand and insists they should wait. "Because this one is all the way on the right-hand track," he explains. "That one must go east when the track split." He points north up the rails to where the dozen different tracks begin to merge, and then to merge again. Beyond a highway overpass, the number of tracks decreases to 3, and then beyond that again, they merge to 2. He and Rebecca walked there yesterday to explore, and they found the place where eventually the two tracks veered in different directions, one east, one west. But Lydia is anxious. They've waited so long already, and she can't imagine not getting on this train. She shakes her head in exasperation. He's right. Two men at least a generation older than Mami are still seated on the far side of an empty track. There are two tracks, one of the men says. They run parallel from here to the village, and then they split. That train is going all the way to Chihuahua. We're waiting for the Pacific Route train, his companion says. They might be identical twins. They have the same weather-beaten faces, the same neatly trimmed mustaches, the same warm timbre to their quiet voices. If you want to cross at Nogales or Baja, you have to take the left-hand track from here.
Thank you, Lydia says.
How do you know? Soledad asks him. She wants to understand how to learn these things. We make this journey every other year. We've done it 8 times.
Lydia's mouth drops open.
Why? Soledad asks. The men shrug in unison. We go where the work is, the first one says. Come back to visit our wives and children, the second one adds. Then we do it again. They both laugh, as if it's a comedy routine they've been performing for years. Soledad removes the backpack she'd put on in preparation for their departure and slams it to the ground.
We've been waiting 3 days, she says. Where is this train? What if it never comes?
It's difficult not to feel hysterical with the passing of the hours, the setting and rising of the sun. Honduras is no farther away today than it was yesterday.
It will come, mija, one of the men nods at her,
and your patience shall be rewarded. He reaches into the front pocket of his backpack and opens a wrapped parcel of carne seca. He hands 2 strips to Soledad and then shares with the others. The train will be along soon, he reassures them.
Luca bites gratefully into the salty, leathery strip. He rips it with his teeth.
The second man leans forward and speaks softly to Soledad, who's sitting on her pack now with her elbows resting on her knees.
And do not worry, Morita. Soon Sinaloa will be well behind you. You will survive this. You have the look of a survivor.
She drops her head low for a moment, so Luca worries about her. He expects that she's crying, that everything she suffered is finally weighing her down, pressing her into the ground. But when she lifts her head, it's the opposite of that. The man's words have landed on her face, and she does. She looks like an Aztec warrior. The twin brothers tell stories while they wait, about their homes in Yucatan, about their wives and children, about the farms where they do seasonal labor in El Norte, and about their third brother, a triplet, who they both agreed was the handsomest brother before he was killed, 6 years ago, when the combine harvester he was driving on a farm in Iowa struck an overhead power line. They bless themselves when they say his name, Eugenio. Luca recognizes the alchemy of recounting their brother's name, and he blesses himself because it's an 8th holy sacrament for migrants, repeating the names of your beloved dead. He tries it quietly on his own tongue.
Sebastián Pérez Delgado.
But the shapes of it are too raw, still too sharp. They flood his mouth with grief, and for a moment, he has to bury his face. He has to breathe into the dark angles of his elbows. He has to fill his mind with other things. The capital of Norway is Oslo. There are 6,852 islands in the Japanese archipelago. The brothers are a deeply calming presence. They are warm bread. They are shelter. And soon, just as the brothers assured them it would, the train arrives. It stops briefly, so they're able to board easily, and after they help them up the ladder, the brothers move along to another car, where they can spread out and give Lydia and the children some space of their own.
See you in El Norte, manito, one of them says to Luca.
Look me up when you get to Iowa. We can have an hamburguesa together. He gives Luca a high five and then turns to follow his brother across the top of the train. Rebecca sits down right where they are.
First class,
Soledad jokes as Mami straps Luca onto the grating. She waves her arm around them.
I got us a private cabin.
The train goes, and when they cross El Rio Fuerte, the landscape changes almost immediately from green to brown. They chug through the difficult farmland for an hour and a half, finally passing a sign that indicates they've crossed into the next state. Luca reads it out loud.
Bienvenido a Sonora. Y vete con viento fresco a Sinaloa.
Rebecca bids good riddance to Sinaloa. But that invisible border does little to ease their newly intensified sense of constant fear.
Bacabachi, Navojoa, Ciudad Obregón.
Check, check, check. The desert asserts itself. Soon Luca can smell the ocean, but this time it reminds him of nothing about Acapulco, because there's no green here, no trees, no mountains, no dense mineral soil. No nightclubs or cruise ships or estadounidenses. Everything is sandy and dusty and dry, and the rock formations that lurch up from the ground have a brutal beauty. Even the trees look thirsty here, and Mami doesn't have to pester Luca to drink. He sips frequently from his canteen, and his hair grows damp with sweat beneath Papi's cap. By sunset, they have, almost unbelievably, reached the city of Hermosillo, which is a place as parched and brown and alien as any Luca has ever seen. But its strangeness makes no impression on him. Such is his mounting excitement.
Rebecca, we're almost there, he says.
He's been trying to pump oxygen back into her flagging person for days. He's like a small human bellows, and she a fire that's dimmed to embers.
Almost where? She says.
The light is drawing out of the sky. The train is slowing. And on the car ahead of them, the twin brothers are making to disembark.
Almost to El Norte, Luca says.
She gives him a skeptical look, which wasn't the response he was hoping for. He snuffles his chin inside the zipper of his hoodie. But Mami leans forward and asks him to repeat himself.
We're almost to El Norte, he says. We're due south of Nogales now, only about 300 miles.
300 miles, Soledad repeats.
What does that mean? How far have we come already?
From Honduras?
Yes.
He tips his head up and squints with thought. I'd say that is more than 2,000 miles. Soledad's eyes get big. A hesitant smile seeps into her features. She makes minimal effort to defeat it. She nods her head.
More than 2,000 miles. We've come more than 2,000 miles?
Yes.
And now we have only 300 left to go?
Yes, that's what I'm telling you. We're getting close.
How long will that take?
300 miles. Soledad asks. Luca shakes his head.
I don't know. A few hours?
Why, you want to stay on the train? Rebecca sounds worried. It's getting dark soon.
Look, we're stopping, Mami says.
The brothers have disembarked and walked a decent stretch already, so it would be easy to miss the sound they emit at that moment, were it not for the fact that Luca, Lydia, Soledad, and Rebecca are all acquainted with that sound now. It's a sound recognizable from both their recent experiences and their nightmares. The brothers are yelling,
Migra! La migra! Huyan! Apúrense! Viene la migra!
This time, the terror doesn't gather or grow. It crashes in on them all at once. Lydia yanks the belt off Luca in a movement so swift and violent he nearly cries. The sisters are already halfway down the ladder, and they don't wait for a reasonable place to get off. The memory of Sinaloa makes them fast, not despite their damaged bodies, but because of them. They leap wildly down to the uneven ground with their unfastened backpacks thudding against them. Luca is next, and then Lydia.
And thank God they're in the city already, because they scramble down the shallow embankment and immediately there are alleys and roads and walls and gardens and houses and open garages and a barefoot little girl gaping at them while she licks at an ice pop, and a woman who has a food cart attached to her bicycle, and a dog with a spot over one eye, and tall grass around their ankles, and then concrete underfoot, and the brothers have gone in a different direction, and there are still three or four other migrants behind them. It's been 4 days since Lydia twisted her ankle, and she's relieved to feel that the twinge has disappeared. It's strong beneath her weight. She looks at the sisters ahead of her and considers what would happen if they got separated now. How or if they'd ever find each other again. She chases after them as quickly as she can, dragging Luca frantically behind her. They run past a shaded garden where a little boy is juggling a ballon de football on his knees, and a woman wearing faded jeans and flip-flops is watering her boxed herbs. She stops when she sees them, and without moving her head or raising her voice, she says, "Oye," in a manner that's so subtle, Lydia almost misses it. But the woman's face has snagged her attention, and again, almost without moving any part of her body, she juts her chin toward the darkened doorway of a covered shed in the back corner of her garden. "Rápido," she says again without raising her voice. Lydia doesn't hesitate to consider the pros and cons. She restrains Luca with one hand on his shoulder and then calls out as quietly as she can, "Rebecca, here." And the sisters skid, turning to look at them. Lydia has already pushed Luca through the gate, and he's running beneath a shade tree with riotous pink blossoms, and he's ducking inside the darkened doorway of that shed. And Lydia is right behind him. And now here come the sisters, until they are all there together, squeezed into the cooled and musty little space, and the exertion of their breath sounds terribly loud, and Lydia can hear the pumping of blood in her ears, a dreadful, vulgar pulse, and she curls her head over her knees and laces her fingers together behind her head, and Luca throws an arm around her lower back, and they all sit as still and silent as possible, until after a few minutes, they hear the mother calling to the little boy, and she says, "Come on, I've picked some oregano for dinner. Inside, let's go." And in the silent moment that follows, the fears that Lydia hadn't paused to entertain before come flocking in and lodge in her throat. "This woman has trapped us here. She has gone to get la policía. She has gone to get someone much worse than la policía. This will be the end of us. Why did I trust her? Why didn't we keep running?" It's too late for these fears, of course, because the decision has been made, and they can't venture out now because they've given up their lead. And now they're stuck here while La Migra combs the neighborhood. Lydia gets hold of herself in the only way she can. Don't think, don't think, don't think. And then they hear the bang of a door, and the woman calls out again to her child, "Close that gate before you come in." And there's a creak and a clang as he slams the gate, the echoing bounce of the ballon when the little boy lets it drop, and then the rumble of a car or truck, a vehicle door opening, slamming, footsteps, and a new voice. "You seen any visitors?" the voice says. "Migrantes?" Lydia's heart feels like machinery in her chest. Rebecca and Soledad are standing, facing each other, their fingers tangled together in the darkness, their heads tipped down in prayer. They cannot hear the little boy's answer. But then the bang of the door and the mother's voice is there again.
"Victor, I told you to come inside," she says.
A man's voice beyond the gate. "We were just asking him if he'd seen any migrants. We had a few get off the train just at the end of the street."
"We haven't seen anyone," she says. "I was out here with him until only a moment ago." "Go inside."
The door bangs once again. "Little girl down the street saw them heading this way."
They must have turned before they got here. We were outside all afternoon. You have a cell phone, or I just call the station house if we see them?
The voices drop lower, become momentarily indiscernible. Lydia opens her eyes wide, as if she can increase her range of hearing that way. At this very moment, Lydia knows the woman may be pointing to the doorway of this shed. She may be mouthing the words, "There are four of them inside the shed." Los agentes de la migra may be unholstering their weapons. Lydia trembles with the thought and closes her eyes again. Her finger slips inside Sebastian's wedding ring. Don't think, don't think, don't think. And then there's a kind of miracle, a tiny distraction. Her finger moves absently through the void of Sebastian's ring and provokes a funny idea, that it's like the magic ring from The Hobbit, that if she slips her finger fully inside and holds on to Luca, it will make them both invisible.
Seguro.
She can make out the woman's words again, a shift of the wind. I picked too much oregano for supper, she's saying. Please, here, take some with you. After the footsteps retreat to the vehicle and the engine rumbles away, and the woman opens and closes the door to her house again, Soledad and Rebecca join Lydia and Luca in sitting on the floor. Slowly, their collective heartbeats return to a normal pace. Slowly, they begin whispering to one another in the darkness.
Should we leave? Soledad asks.
Not yet, Lydia says. They're still searching the neighborhood. Let's wait until it's really dark out. Rebecca is crying, hunched over her legs. Luca touches her hand and she flinches, which hurts his feelings. But instead of withdrawing, he persists. And then Rebecca softens, melts into him like a pat of butter on a pan. Luca pulls her head onto his shoulder and strokes her hair.
It's okay. Nothing bad happened, he tells her. It's okay.
I can't do this anymore, she says. It's too frightening.
Stop it, Soledad says.
I just want to die. I want it to be over, Rebecca says without any inflection to her voice at all.
Well, you don't get to decide that, Rebecca, her sister says.
I want to go home.
There is no home. We're going to make a new home. This is the only way forward, so we go forward. Adelante. No more crying now.
Soledad wipes at her sister's face with her thumbs, and the tough love works. Rebecca sits up and makes a loud sniff and is finished with her despair.
We're almost there, Soledad says. You heard Luca earlier. 300 miles, right, chiquito?
That's right, Luca says.
300 miles, Soledad says. And then it's all over. All this nightmare, the whole thing, all of it. We will be in El Norte where no one can hurt us anymore. We'll make a good, safe life, and Papi will get better, and we'll send for him. And then we'll bring Mami and Abuela too. Everything will be better. You'll see.
Rebecca doesn't believe a single word of it. She doesn't even understand how Soledad can preserve that kind of naivete after everything she's been through. Rebecca has been cured of innocence. She knows there's no safe place for them in the world, that El Norte will be the same as anywhere else. Hope cannot survive the poison of her recent proof. The world is a terrible place. San Pedro Sula was terrible. Mexico is terrible. El Norte will be terrible. Even her gold-dappled memories of the cloud forest are beginning to rot and decay. When she reaches back in her mind now, it's not her mother's voice she remembers, or the scent of drying herbs, or the chorus of the tree frogs at night, or the cool wash of the clouds on her arms and hair. It's the poverty that drove her father and all the men away to the cities. It's the advancing threat of the cartels, the want of resources, the ever-present hunger. so it's only for the sake of her sister that Rebecca nods her head.
Everything we've been through, Soledad says, it'll all be worth it. We'll leave it behind and have a new beginning.
Rebecca looks at the floor, but her eyes are unfocused.
Like it never happened, she says.
They stay in the shed while Victor and his mother eat supper in the house, while the neighbors come home from work and greet their families, while the clouds skid across the lid of Hermosillo and the sun sinks orange into the horizon. Beyond the perimeter of the city, the Sonoran desert trades heat with the sky. As twilight cools the land and the human city prepares for sleep, the desert pops and teems with life. Lydia and the sisters plan to rest until the neighborhood is entirely quiet, to slip out during the darkest hours of the night. Luca is too hungry to sleep, so he's very grateful when the woman appears with a pot of cold beans and a stack of dry tortillas. She places these items on the floor among them and then steps back toward the doorway. Luca doesn't wait for her to leave. He uses a tortilla to scoop up the beans and almost bites his finger in his hurry. There's no light, but their eyes have adjusted to the dark. The woman whispers, "You can rest here for a while, but please be gone before daylight." Chapter 25. Before dawn, Lydia, Luca, and the sisters walk deeper into the city, where they discover that the railway fence in Hermosillo is serious business, expensive infrastructure. Tax pesos at work. In fact, it's not a fence at all, but a concrete wall topped with razor wire in threatening coils. Inside that wall, a train rumbles past with migrants asleep on top, their arms folded across their chests, their hats over their faces. On this side of the wall, six migrant men sleep wrapped around their packs while one keeps watch. He has no shoes. He greets them as they approach.
"What happened to your shoes?" Lydia asks.
"Stolen," he says. Soledad recognizes his Honduran accent.
"Ay, cataracho, qué barbaridad."
He nods, scratches his chin. "At least they didn't get my beard," he says. Lydia cannot stop thinking about the man, even after they've passed well beyond him, farther into the city, where they have to find breakfast and stock up their water supply. How could he make a joke like that? A man so destitute that even his shoes have been taken from him. Lydia is rationing toothpaste. Her hair feels greasy and her skin dry. She's aware of these discomforts daily. If someone took her shoes, she would give up, she thinks. That would be the ultimate indignity. 16 dead family members she can survive, as long as her toes are not naked before the world. They find a large park with broad paved walkways and a string of orange porta-potties left over from a concert the night before. Luca leans over the edge of a fountain and submerges his arms up to the elbow. Lydia has a growing sense that her very humanity is under siege. So as a flimsy defense against that attack, she permits herself to spend 10 pesos on a cup of coffee from a vendor. The caffeine hits her bloodstream like a dream of another life. She sips it slowly and allows the steam to curl around her face while she thinks about that man and his shoes. The encounter has provoked in her an urgent feeling about the importance of shoes. So she will convert some portion of the remaining money to new shoes now, she decides, here in Hermosillo, today. She looks to the girl's feet as well and notices that both of their sneakers could use replacing. They wear low-top Converses. Soledad's are black and Rebecca's gray. The shoes are sun-faded and worn, but at least they're comfortable, well broken in, Lydia tells herself. She wishes she had extra money. They wait in the park until the shops open, and Lydia spends almost half their remaining cash on two decent pairs of hiking boots for herself and Luca.
They're just ordinary leather with heavy stitching and thick rubber soles. But no, these boots are miraculous, extraordinary. They are mythological winged sandals. These are the boots that will cross the desert passage to El Norte. It feels like a crater in her chest when Lydia hands over her money. There are many migrants gathered beside the track in Hermosillo, and some of the campsites appear permanent. An older couple sits on a plaid couch beneath a tarp while the woman tends to a fire where you might expect a coffee table to be. Just outside the expensive gate, no one seems to care that migrants are waiting for La Bestia. The fence ends at the gated opening across the tracks, and just inside that gate, two guards sit in the shade of a small hut, waiting to open and close the gate when the train is ready. The gate, like the fence, is topped with razor wire, but there's nothing to stop migrants from slipping underneath the gate, where there's a 2-foot gap Luca could easily roll through. Anyone could go under the fence here, and the guards don't seem interested in preventing them, but no one tries. They're content to wait just outside the gate instead, where the other migrants inform Lydia the train will emerge from its cage eventually, slowly, and everyone will clamor on. The wait there with the other migrants feels like the longest stretch of hours in Soledad's life. Ever since Luca told her how close they are to El Norte, she fancies she can smell it there on the horizon, all McNuggets and fresh Nikes. She can almost see it shimmering in the distance, and her whole body twitches with a yearning for it. She leans north with her spine, her eyes, her lungs, while the others sleep that night on the cold-packed earth against the cinder block wall of the bordering gardens. She paces the tracks in the moonlight, tense with fear that something more will happen now that they're this close. Some fresh horror will swoop down on them and steal the dream they've almost accomplished. She tries to doze, and when her head begins to pound, she realizes she's been holding her breath. In the morning, a local resident drapes a hose over the garden wall so the migrants can brush their teeth, wet their faces, and fill their canteens. A contingent of older ladies walks the tracks, passing out blessings with homemade bagged sandwiches and pickles. A guard from the hut calls Luca over and passes him a grape lollipop through the chain-link fence. Lydia is on alert at all times now, for Lorenzo, or for anyone like Lorenzo, for anyone who might recognize her. Whenever there's a delay of this sort, her worry grows that he'll catch up to them, that he'll appear walking toward them at any moment, or that someone else will have too much time to think it over and there will be a snap. An aha! She keeps the ugly pink hat flopped over her face all the time.
Mommy, can I wear my sneakers? Luca asks.
He's been wearing the new boots since yesterday, and they're stiff. She wants him to break them in, but he has to do it in small doses. There's no point in him getting blisters before they even get to the desert. His blue sneakers are tied together by the laces and strung through one strap of his backpack.
Go ahead and change, she says.
When he takes the boots off, she gathers them up and ties them together in the same fashion. She changes hers too. It's late morning when there's a squawk from the radio in the guard's hut, and the migrants sit up and take notice. Minutes later, the guards swing their expensive gates wide open for the train that appears in the distance. The cage is open, and now all they have to do is wait while the train chugs slowly toward them. The migrants clamber aboard in groups, women and children first. The men help, and the guards watch. One guard even tosses a migrant's backpack up to him after it rolls off the edge. Lydia catches Soledad's eye.
Don't forget to be afraid, she says.
This is not normal, Soledad responds. But they're up quickly, easily,
and the train doesn't pick up substantial speed until everyone is aboard, almost as if the engineer was taking care to safely accommodate the migrants, to give them a boost. Lydia blesses herself anyway. She traces the sign of the cross on Luca's forehead every time. And then a strange thing happens as they travel north, out of Hermosillo and deeper into the Sonoran Desert. They begin to notice other migrants moving in the opposite direction. Just a trickle at first, two on foot, and then another two. And Lydia cannot imagine where they've come from, walking south as they are, and emerging from what seem to be endless tracts of vast and barren desert. They are unmistakably migrants. She's not sure how she knows this, but she does. Still, there's something different about them. And it's not only that they're traveling in the wrong direction. Lydia can't put her finger on it. Then, only a few miles north of Hermosillo, a second line of track sidles up alongside theirs, because the vast majority of the Mexican railways are single track lines. These laybys, these miniature exit ramps, exist at intervals so one train can pull off and idle to await the approach of another coming from the opposite direction. In this way, the trains can pass one another north and south and carry on, using the same line of track to their destinations. It's in just such a layby that they see a southbound train now idling, and Soledad sits up taller as they approach it. She shields her eyes from the sun in case they're playing tricks on her. But no, it's true. The southbound train is packed with migrants. They wave and salute and call out greetings to them as their train slows to a clacking crawl to pass.
"Where are they going?" Rebecca asks no one.
The second line of track is separated from theirs by a space of only 5 or 6 feet, and one young boy, not much older than Luca, is standing atop the southbound train. He seems to be gauging whether or not he could jump the gap. A group of men yell and gesture wildly at him, so he clambers down the nearby ladder instead and jumps down to the ground. Then he runs north alongside the northbound train. The train is traveling quite slowly now, and Luca leans over the edge in astonishment to watch the running boy beneath. He looks up at Luca and grins. He grips the moving ladder of Luca's freight car and hauls himself up. Luca leans back up and waits for the boy's head to emerge over the lip, which is black and shiny in the desert sunlight. On the idling southbound train, a loud cheer goes up for the boy's victorious transfer, and the boy shouts back to the men, who all wave and smile.
"Vaya con Dios!"
the boy yells at the men he's leaving behind.
"Ya me voy pa'l otro lado!"
Another cheer.
"Be careful and God bless you," another man yells.
And then the train begins to gain speed again, and the clacking returns to its shriek and rumble, and the boy walks over to them without even crouching, and he plops himself down carelessly. Unlike most migrants, the boy does not carry anything, nor does he wear a hat to shield his berry brown face from the sun. Because of that fact, his exposed features are dry and burnished. His lips are cracked with peels of white, but the chapping doesn't interfere with the brightness of his smile. He puts his hand out to bump fists with Luca, who responds reflexively, the way any 8-year-old boy would, without even thinking.
¿Qué onda, güey?
The boy says, using the borderland slang that marks him immediately as a northerner. Luca doesn't know exactly what ¿qué onda, güey? Means, because he doesn't know anyone who talks like this, but he understands enough to know it's a friendly greeting, so he replies by saying hello. Lydia, who believed her capacity for surprise had been exhausted, is genuinely taken aback by the boy's arrival. She doesn't know what to make of him. On the one hand, he gives the instant impression of being gregarious, friendly, charismatic. On the other hand, she's wary of everyone she meets now, and although this child seems very young, She knows that boys this age are prime candidates for gang recruitment. And why is he alone? Why so friendly with Luca? She puts one arm defensively around her son. This child's face is round, his eyes, nose, and cheeks all round. His eyelids look puffy, but the black eyes beneath them are clear and intense. He's wheezing slightly, and as they all watch, he removes an inhaler from the pocket of his jeans, shakes it vigorously, places it to his lips, and takes a puff. Then he breathes deeply and coughs a little. "It's empty," he shrugs, replacing the inhaler in his pocket. "But the memory of the medicine helps." Luca smiles, but Lydia furrows her brow. "Will you be okay?" she asks. Despite her instinctive suspicion, she's still a mother, and you can't fake a wheeze like that. The boy coughs again, once, twice, and then spits something solid over the edge of the train car. "It will pass in a minute," he wheezes. They watch him for signs of a medical emergency, though it's unclear how they could help if the episode does not, in fact, pass. He sits up straight, looks out across the landscape, folds his legs into the shape of a pretzel, and concentrates on breathing slowly. As he does this, Lydia's relieved to see the existence of a hole in the sole of his sneaker. No boy with an empty inhaler and a hole in his sneaker could belong to a gang or cartel. After he manages to regain a steady breath, the boy turns to Luca and says, "I'm Beto. What's your name?" "Hello, Beto. I'm Luca." Beto nods. Their train is passing a village that seems to have grown right out of the tracks. Just a cluster of houses, the same rusty color as the land, and two competing taquerias that face off across the lone street. "Is your breathing better now?" Luca asks. "Yeah, it's fine," Beto says. "Happens whenever I run too fast. But you learn to be calm until it passes, because if you freak out, that makes it worse." Luca nods. "It's cool to meet another kid," Beto announces then. "I don't see that many kids out here. How old are you?"
8.
"I'm 10, almost 11 though." He says this like a very wise old man. Luca has about 1,000 questions for Beto, but the effect of having them all packed so tightly together in his brain is that none of them shakes loose and gets through the gate. Lydia leans into the opening left by Luca's silence. "Beto, are you traveling alone?" Luca can tell that his mommy is trying not to sound judgmental, but the effort isn't entirely successful. Beto doesn't seem to care, or even to notice.
"Yep, just me," he grins, displaying the absence of two teeth on the bottom, a canine, and a molar side by side, so the hole is a double wide. Beto sticks his tongue through it. Now it's Soledad's turn.
"Were you traveling south?" she asks.
"I was, temporarily, but now I'm traveling north," he says without irony.
Soledad doesn't know quite how to respond, but Beto saves her the trouble by changing the subject.
"Wow, you're really pretty," he says.
Soledad blinks but doesn't respond.
"Must be a pain in the ass, huh?"
She laughs. He returns his attention to Luca. "So where are you guys from?" Luca glances at Mommy, who responds with only the tiniest shake of her head.
"Mommy and I are from Puebla," he decides.
"And the sisters are Ecuadorian."
Beto nods. The lie doesn't matter at all. Those places may as well be Antarctica or Mars as far as he's concerned.
"How about you?" Luca asks. "Where are you from?"
"I'm from Tijuana," Beto says. "But we call it TJ. I was born there in the Dompe."
An utterly bizarre piece of information. So odd, in fact, that Luca is not sure he understands. Again, this is an unfamiliar word, Dompe. Luca looks at Mommy to translate, but she seems confused as well.
"What's a Dompe?" Luca asks.
Beto smirks.
You know, at Dompe, where people dump their garbage. The trucks come, you know, at Dompe.
You mean like a vertedero? Luca asks, using the Spanish word for dump.
Yeah, vertedero,
Beto says. Lydia, because her English is slightly more sophisticated than Luca's, begins to understand that this boy's native language is not exactly the Spanish of Mexico, nor is it the English of the United States, but rather some kind of semantic borderland crossbreed. Still, this insight does nothing to clarify what the boy means when he says he was born in a dompe. Luca literally scratches his head, a gesture Lydia hasn't seen him make, she now realizes, since the decimation of their family. It's a gesture that, in fact, she never noticed before, and therefore she didn't miss when it vanished. But now that she sees it again, she's floored by an accompanying revelation that the gesture, one thumb on top of his ear, three fingers raking through his hair above, is specific to Luca's intellectual curiosity. It's a tic that happens only when he's intrigued by something, when he finds something interesting. The reappearance of it, therefore, feels to Lydia like evidence that her son might survive, that he might be capable, after 15 days and 1,400 miles, of temporarily losing himself in a moment of uncorrupted curiosity. The feeling that thuds through her sternum is hope.
So you were born in a garbage dump? Luca asks carefully, trying not to be rude and not understanding that there's nothing at all discourteous about the question, because Beto is neither ashamed of the facts of his origin, nor, for that matter, even aware that the facts of his origin might, in other people, incite feelings of discomfort. His origin is simply his origin, and he tells a story without any kind of appreciation of the effect it might provoke. He laughs.
Yeah, well, I wasn't born in the garbage, though, just near it, in Colonia Fausto González. You heard of it?
Luca shakes his head. It's kind of famous, Beto says proudly.
Lydia knows a little about Las Colonias of Tijuana because she's read the books, because Luis Alberto Urrea is one of her favorite writers, and he's written about the dumps, about kids like Beto who live there. That flare of recognition makes her feel like she knows him already, at least slightly. But that feeling is half hollow, a shadow puppet. Because though she may understand something of this boy's circumstances, she doesn't know him. Still, the familiarity has the effect of thawing the part of her that would otherwise remain hardened to him. And then Beto tells them his whole life story. All of it, without stopping, without even really taking a breath. How he doesn't remember his father, who went to El Norte when Beto was still a baby. But he remembers his mommy, who was a garbage picker in El Dompe before they closed it. And he remembers his big brother, Ignacio, who's still there in El Dompe, buried beneath a sky-blue hand-painted cross with his name, Ignacio, and the words, Mijo, 10 años. Beto reminds Luca that he's 10 years old and explains that that's the same age his brother Ignacio was when he was squashed by the back tire of a garbage truck while reaching for the miraculous, round, unblemished sphere of a balón de fútbol he'd spotted amid the refuse. An unprecedented treasure. Beto, who was 8 years old and standing nearby at the time, was so stunned by Ignacio's screams that he failed to secure the balón for his dying brother. Instead, a pimple-faced kid named Omar got it. Because of the softness of the ground beneath the truck's tires, Beto explains, Ignacio was not entirely flattened, but rather compressed into the garbage beneath him, crushed just enough that he survived for 3 dreadful days. It wasn't long after that, and the sky blue cross, that Beto's mami disappeared, too. First into a drunken stupor, next into a new, more rancid haze, and finally, into the ether. Beto is afraid of turning 11, because it feels like a treachery to his brother. But I guess it would be worse to not turn 11, right? He laughs, and Lydia and the sisters attempt to join him in the sound. Luca does not laugh, but feels compelled to give the boy something in return for his story. He unzips the side pocket of his backpack, which is sitting in his lap, and fishes out his tube of orange mango blast Blistex. He hands it to Beto, who takes it without saying anything, removes the cap, smears it across his lips, and then makes a loud ah sound. He hands it back to Luca and doesn't say thank you, but Luca knows the ah was an expression of gratitude. So wait, Soledad says, finally turning her whole body toward him instead of just her head. Isn't Tijuana right at the border? Yeah, it is, Luca says, looking at Soledad with approval. She intercepts the look. You're not the only one who can read a map around here, she says, and then back to the newcomer. So then, what are you doing here if you were already right at the border? Why were you traveling south? And all those other migrants, too, traveling south. Oh, those guys are all deportados. Soledad cringes. All of them? Sure, Beto shrugs. TJ is full of deportados. There's more people going south and north in Tijuana. You can tell them apart for the regular migrants because of their uniforms. Uniforms? Luca asks. Yeah, all the migrants wear the same uniforms, right? Dirty jeans, busted shoes, baseball hats. You don't have a hat, Luca observes. Beto shrugs. I'm not a real migrant. I'm just a poser. So what's different about the deportados then? Soledad prompts him back to the subject. They are hunted by the cries of their absent children in El Norte. They all stare at him. I'm just messing, he says. It's that they don't have backpacks. Lydia snaps her fingers. The backpacks, she says. Yes, that's what they were missing, the backpacks. Why don't they have backpacks? Luca asks. Because they're deportados. They live in the United States way, like forever, like for 10 years maybe, since they were babies maybe. And then they're on their way to work one morning or coming home from school one day or playing football in the park. Or shopping at the mall for some fresh new kicks, and then bam, they get deported with whatever they happen to be carrying when they're picked up. So unless they happen to be carrying a backpack when La Migra gets them, they usually come empty-handed. Sometimes the women have their purse with them or whatever. They don't get to go home and pack a bag, but they usually have nice clothes, at least, clean shoes.
Lydia clutches her pack in front of her. She doesn't want to think about this. The dream of getting to Estados Unidos is the only thing sustaining them right now. She's not prepared to begin considering all the horrible things that might happen after, if they're lucky enough to achieve the first, most fundamental goal. Soledad sits back and bites her lip. So when they get deported, they just give up and go home? She asks. Why don't they try to cross back over?
I mean, some of them try, Beto explains, but it's impossible to cross at Tijuana now, unless you have, like, tons of money or you're working with one of the cartels. They got tunnels. A few years ago, it was easy. I even knew some guys from El Dompe who would make extra money taking migrants across. The fence was full of holes, plus ladders, boats. There were 1,000 ways to get across.
And now?
Now it's like a war zone, all drones and cameras and La Migra just waiting over there like a gang of overpaid goalkeepers. Plus, los deportados got money. They're all rich from working in El Norte, so they can afford a vacation before they go back. They go home to visit.
Soledad bites nervously at the inside of her lip.
But don't worry, Beto says. Nogales is supposed to be better. I mean, it's supposed to be easier to get across, because nobody wants to cross in the desert and stuff, so there's not as much border patrol. That's why I didn't try to cross at TJ. I'm going to Nogales to get across.
Beto presses his lips together, and Luca can smell the orange and mango of the Blistex. It gives him a feeling of gladness.
That's where this train is going, right? Nogales?
Beto asks, leaning back on his elbows and stretching his legs in front of him.
We hope so, Luca says. There's one more major junction, Beto says. At Benjamin Hill, the tracks split. Straight north to Nogales or west to Baja. When I was coming down, I was supposed to get off there and change trains, but we didn't stop. So I just kept rolling south until we hit that lay-by. He sighs. I hope we don't end up back in Tijuana. Imagine if I just did a bestia sightseeing tour of the countryside and wound up back in El Dompe.
Soledad groans.
So you mean we might have to change again? She says. When we're this close?
I guess we'll see, Beto says, reaching into his pocket and drawing out a fistful of sunflower seeds. He munches them and spits the shells over the edge of the train without sitting up. He offers to share them with the others, but his hands are sweaty, and no one takes him up on his generosity.
How long have you been traveling? Soledad asks him.
Only a few days, he says. I guess this is my third or fourth day.
That your sister?
He points at Rebecca with his chin. She's only half facing them, watching the passage of the impossible landscape, scrubby welters of green growing from the powdery earth, the arc of hot blue above them, the serrated brown of the distant mountains, the increasingly rare sight of a vehicle on the parallel highway.
Yes, that's Rebecca, she says, and I'm Soledad.
How come she's so quiet? Beto asks.
She doesn't talk.